right, guys, it's mentioned in dispatches time. And I say we're going to be recording tonight. Who knows? This may take us into the wee hours of the morning. We'll have to see. This seems to be the season in which we attempt to outdo ourselves by continually setting new records for length of podcast. Joining us tonight, Ian, the Rocky Mountain Navy, I was trying to figure out the full naval style title for who you would be. And I think it's sort of, Com Rock Nave or something like, you know, the Commodore of the Rocky Mountain Navy. I couldn't fully abbreviate it. So
yeah, just Rocky Mountain Navy works.
Sure. Welcome back, Ian, for return engagement. And, first time this season, I think that Mo has joined us of Mo's Game Table. Welcome, Mo.
Hey, how's it going? I think we'll call him Sink Rock. That's what we'll call him.
There, yeah, Sink Rock. There we are.
But I can
that
swim.
Works on so many levels. So there's been a lot of discussion online. We'll try to find the polite way to say this, right? There's been a lot of discussion online, and some of the discussion recorded here on this podcast about, you know, lots of reactions to the Charles S. Roberts Awards and to the Charlies and the games that were awarded and the games that were nominated and some of the ways in which things were done. We recorded a long podcast on it. Mo, you did a show that was damn near just as long. I think you guys ran longer than we did.
Probably.
yeah. With Kevin, with Gimpy on there with you. Ian wrote a very good analysis that looked historically back through the Charlies as well, at some of the different awards over the years. And really a lot of the issues seem to come around to, you know, what should have been nominated, what could have been nominated, what should have won, what did win, all of those different things. And so tonight, 6 years ago on another podcast in another life, we attempted to tackle this question and we had to split the podcast in half. And no, I'm not kidding. It was actually a two-part podcast. But tonight we are going to attempt to tackle that often contentious, controversial, I'm sure we'll come up with a good synonym. What is a war game, right? We're going to try to figure out what is a war game. And I'm pretty sure I've got my answer, and we all know that it's the right one. But we've got Ian and Mo here to argue with me to help prove my rightness. So, Ian, you go first. What is a war game? What do you got?
Yes, over to Mo.
Well, I think we're all war gamers, so what we can do is we can throw out a whole bunch of stuff and war game it out and figure it out. But I would say that – it's just to keep it in a nutshell and not make this into a multi-part series, which we made the joke about. It is a game where it's going to be a game that is an opposed adversarial military-based simulation that will recreate a specific historical event or as an exploration of potential military conflict or an operation in game form. That's the way I would kind of consolidate it.
Did you write all that down just so you'd have it to read from?
No.
In advance of this?
No.
Okay.
I was thinking about it ahead of time because I was like, if I don't have it in good format, it's just going to be like, it's going to be a simulation about military. Yeah. I had it all kind of in my head, but other than that, no, I didn't write it down.
I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure if you had it written down ahead of time. But
I probably should have.
Yeah. Well, but again, like we all came into tonight knowing what the topic was going to be. So it wouldn't have surprised me if you had, you know, it would have been totally acceptable. Sure. It's not like that's cheating, you know.
No balance.
Ian, you want to grab that and riff off of it?
Sure. I'll just say I'll start off with, you know, coming into tonight's podcast, I actually went through and I tried to come up with a definition. The first thing I did is I went to go back and look at other definitions. And, you know, 20 some definitions later, I sort of don't know because it goes all over the place. I think Mo there hit a couple of the big pieces, you know, opposed military action. There's disagreement. Does it have to be military? Is it just a competition of a sort? Mo used the word simulation in there. There's people have gone back and forth over, you know, do we really want to call it a simulation or do we want to call it a game? I think that some folks get mixed up by trying to call a war game by what it is physically. I think Dunnigan did us no favors here because he said a war game combines a map, playing pieces, historical personages, and historical units, and a set of rules. But a war game isn't the physical board. It doesn't. It's more a thought process. Mm-hmm. For me, I got to go something fairly recent. So Una Wong and Sebastian Elizabeth Bartles did a study for Rand with for the Marines, and they had to try to wrestle with what a war game is. But I think they hit upon a factor that I think it's missed and lost a lot, is that a war game is decision. Actors who make decisions in an environment they seek to affect, with rules that govern what they can do, and then some sort of an adjudication. Now, some folks might say that, wow, you're getting too technical. But at the end of the day, what it really comes down to is war games are decisions about some sort of competition. You have an environment, a board, or some sort of presented to you in some way, and rules that tell you what can you do. And then there's an adjudication model, be it dice, be it cards. So really wide open. For me, it all comes down to a war game is a competition game.
Yeah. So I have my answer that I gave quite a while ago, and I will get there in just a second. But for me, part of what needs to happen in every one of these cases, when we start trying to come up with the definitions of these things, one of the first things I want to do with every definition that we could possibly come up with and think our way through is I want to run it through a bunch of samples, right? Let's grab 10 random games off our shelf and let's apply that definition to each of those games and see what gets screened in and what gets screened out. And to me, part of that comes down to, a lot of wargamers, they want to talk about the air quotes, right? Traditional wargaming, hexes, counters, dice, zones of control, whatever kind of stuff. the problem with describing it by the physical form is that you have now screened in leaping lemmings and you have screened out up front. And so, there's one set of definitions that's not great. There are other definitions that, you talk about opposed sides in a competition with decisions in an adjudication model, and, Carcassonne fits that description. And I'm not sure we would necessarily consider that a war game. And so my definition on all of this that I've been operating from for a while is it is a game, not necessarily a simulation. And I'll come back to that later if we've got the time by the end of all this. But it is a game that is where the primary path to victory has to be military conflict. Otherwise, it's not a war game. And to me, that's the biggest challenge in a lot of these things. Jim Ozarski has frequently brought out a quote that he's got it from somebody else, but I just always remember Jim using it. And he's, a war game is a game in which when I'm playing it, I feel like I'm at war. I feel like I'm recreating a war on the table. That's kind of touchy-feely, and that's fine from a first-person point of view, but I think if we're attempting to draw some empirical lines around things and definitively screen stuff in versus out, that doesn't really do it for me, because what somebody might feel like they're at war, somebody else might not, and somebody might need Gettysburg, where somebody else, Twilight Struggle, is sufficiently conflicted. And so for me, the idea of a game in which military conflict is the primary path to victory leaves open the ability to have something like an economic engine as an essential component to it. Axis and Allies has an economic engine. Third Reich has an economic engine as a part of it. But the way you win the game is through military conflict. The civilization games, like over on the computer, or even the tabletop civ games, I wouldn't consider those war games, because the primary path to victory is not necessarily military. I've won games of civilization over the years without ever going to war with anything but barbarians. And so I don't know that I can really call that a war game. It's certainly an enjoyable game, and I'm not trying to say that, because it's not a war game, I don't like it. But I don't know that I'd call that a war game.
Well, yeah, that would be more of a history-based game.
Yeah. And there are all kinds of strategy games out there that are not war games, and that's totally cool. Like, I'm down with that. But I think if we're looking for a war game, it transcends form factor, but one in which military action is primarily the way in which you win. And that, in my mind, I sort of struggle with that a little bit. Like, okay, so do the coin games get screened in or out based on my definition? And I got to say that they may get screened out as a result of that. Now you're moving around forces and bases that are sort of largely abstract bits of military, military assets. But I'm not necessarily sure they're always the primary path to victory. And quite frankly, I think that's sort of the point of the coin games, is that you can't shoot your way out of an insurgency necessarily. With that on the table now, Ian, what do you think?
So you've sort of hit upon what Matt Caffrey from the Air Force, who's a longtime wargamer and does a lot of professional wargaming. What he wrote about in his book on wargaming, how wargames have shaped history and how they may shape the future, for an Air Force guy, was printed by the Navy, Naval War College. You can download it for free. It's a great little history book. But he actually, you know, I challenge you to think about it this way too, is do we have to have one definition for a wargamer? Can we do what McCaffrey does? He looks at four generations of wargames. What you're talking about is armed conflict, sort of war game. He calls that his third generation war game. Interesting, you should say civilization, because he calls civilization, he calls it out in his book as a fourth generation war game, or as he says, a peace game, because it's a competition between nations where peace or war are both plausible paths to victory. So,
yeah.
I mean, maybe what we have here is, I think on the hobbyist side of the house, there's definitely a move to say, hey, war games have to be military. You look at Board Game Geek, you know, the wiki's a wiki, but you know, they start off by saying the game in which players put military units or military type units in direct or indirect conflict with each other. I think from a hobbyist perspective, yes, we have to definitely say it's got to be military, but I'll just throw in from the professional side of the house, professional wargaming side of the house, it doesn't necessarily have to be military. It can just be competition between nations. I do defense planning every once in a while. And a lot of people look at war plans or the O plans and say, oh, look, hey, these are all plans to go to war. But if you really look at an O plan, especially before you get to conflict, there's a lot of planning on how do you deter the enemy? How do you do those off ramps to a peaceful settlement, not get into the war? It's a war plan, but it also has many great peaceful off ramps.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, maybe we're mixing it up by saying, you know, war games are more than just military. But I think in the hobbyist side of the house, definitely, I think I'd be comfortable saying war games have to be involved the military side. The professionals are going to tell you something a little bit different.
Well, I think you bring up a very important and valid point in that the genesis of tonight's discussion was very much a reaction to the Charlies, which are not focused on the professional wargaming world at all. And we probably should have led off with, hey, we're talking about hobby wargaming here. Because on the professional side of things, it's not just that you've got all those different considerations that you've brought in. You're doing them for potentially very different reasons as well. You may be, you know, John Compton does a ton of analytical wargaming where he's using wargaming for all sorts of different analysis purposes for the DoD. You may be doing them for training, for rehearsal, for concept testing, for all kinds of different reasons. And so I think we almost have to leave the professional world aside a little bit because those definitions are going to be so different, even in the professional world among different contexts and usages of wargaming. I think we've all had varying degrees of experience with wargaming on the professional side and, you know, wearing other hats in our lives. I think we've all got some comfort level with that. Obviously a lot of the hobbyists are going to see it as sort of a potential military training tool, but I think really where we're looking at tonight, I think we're primarily focused on the hobby side of things. As a side note,
to the second part, which is so much of the hobby side tries to define a war game by what you were talking about, try to define it by physically what it is. Oh, it has hexes. It has a CRT. It doesn't have little standy men. It's got these chits with the little, you know, boxes on them. Oh, that's a war game. And why would I want to play that? Because that's not my, Euro game of choice.
Yeah.
So I think that leads to the second problem is people try to define it by what it looks like, which immediately falls apart. I mean, a few years back, I was going through a phase where I was trying to figure out which ones are the Waros in my collection, or Waros, whatever you want to call them. You know, war games using Euro game mechanics, you know, great games like Supply Lines of the American Revolution, Tom Russell over at Hollenspiel.
Yep.
Is that a war game? I mean, you have cubes on a map and you're really worried about supply. There's no hexes. There's no real CRT. Yeah, it's, has some dice in it. But I think that just illustrates the problem is that you can't define it by what it physically looks like, because there's so many things out there that cover those military events that are not simple hex encounter games.
Yeah.
So
we're
working our way around to saying, I don't know what it is. I know a war game when I see it.
I know a war game when it shows up on Mo's YouTube channel.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's kind of difficult to necessarily put them all into perspective because things do broaden out and they have, you know, expanded as we've seen things evolve in the war game community. But from the professional perspective, it's definitely going to be more of the verb and the adjective rather than just the noun. Whereas we're, you know, when it comes to war games for us, it's a noun. It's a war game. Whereas in the professional side of things, they're going to war game things out. They're going to play out different situations, whether it's peace, a crisis, or if it's actual combat, they're going to war game out all different aspects of it so they can test out different plans, policies, procedures, things like that. When yep. we're talking about it, it's literally just cracking open a game and playing a war game, whether it's with counters, if it's blocks, if it's cubes, whatever. Because even like in coin, you have it's area control and you're going to have different areas that you're going to be fighting over and you're going to be using the cards in the game to do different things, do different types of operations. And yeah, it's abstracted out with counters rather, not counters, but cubes rather than counters. But it's the same thing or a similar thing, not the exact same thing, obviously, because it's very abstract, whereas a counter is a lot more specific, even though it's still abstracted out. It's more specific. You're trying to actually model to a degree the efficacy of that unit, whether it's an armor unit, infantry, whatever.
Yep.
When you're dealing with coin, you're just dealing with a cube and yeah, that's going to do specific things. Yeah. It's a simple abstract force. So it's a little different there, but it's a war game, you know, and it does have Euro elements and there are Euro elements that have been brought into war games and war game elements that have been brought into Euro games. So there's some crossover there, but, and that's a great thing. And it's wonderful to have that because then you have that crossover, that appeal that can draw in the non-war gamers into war games and find out, you know, hey, they're not all crazy, super complicated games to play. They're a lot of fun. Join in and enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's something that I've brought up in the past also in terms of the war game crowd to which all three of us absolutely belong. We've got a sense of the different kinds of war games that we sort of that are the bulk of our collections. You know, I'm eyeballing the shelf over here and just, you know, on the second shelf reading across, I've got Soldier Kings, Maneuver, Germany at War, Squad Leader, the Fab Sicily, Band of Heroes, Pacific War. I've got two of the tank on tank boxes, a Distant Plain, Day of Heroes, Persian Incursion. Like that's one shelf working my way across. There's probably a couple things I missed up there. Oh, Quartermaster General's up there. That's the norm for many of us for our game collection. And over on another shelf, I've got a bunch of Euros, right? I've got Seven Wonders. I've got Carcassonne inside because I can get the kids to play that one with mm-hmm. me. So my wife will actually play Ticket to Ride with us, which is kind of cool. So I've got those inside and we'll play those as well. But there are a lot of those war games that I listed are from publishers who are primarily war game publishers, right? That's Lock and Load and GMT and Venta Nuovo, you know, the Clash of Arms. That's who the publishers on those things are. We all probably know plenty of people who on their shelves are primarily loaded down with the Carcassones and Ticket to Rides and Seven Wonders and Power Grids of the world that also have Memoir 44, that also have Heroes of Normandy, that also have two or three different Axis and Allies boxes. Damn near everybody on the planet's got a copy of Risk, at least one version of Risk. You want to talk about abstracted out forces right there. Let's just move lots of Risk cubes around.
Star Wars Risk is the best.
I'm a big fan of the 2210 AD one, the space nice. One where you can, you've also got the moon in play. So there are things that I think we would all clearly define as war games that non-war gamers will play, whether it's a different face on them or a different level of availability, because I can find Axis and Allies in Target. I can't find GMT stuff in Target. Whether it's a perceived simplicity in the rules of one relative to the other, not an actual, right? Real careful there, but a perceived simplicity in the rules, whether it's just what friends have managed to introduce somebody to over time, whatever it may be. I think there's plenty of wargaming as a verb going on in other hobby communities than ours that we don't always recognize as much because we don't pay, we're not around them as much to pay that much attention, but because it's only a small percentage of the overall game playing that they are doing. It doesn't register on the radar quite as much as the things we're normally looking for, right? The GMTs and the lock and load world. So I think, you know, you're right in that there are lots of different form factors it can take. Memoir 44 has got the figures as a, for instance, right? They're not the only one. Battlecry had figures. But I think there's the old guard in our hobby have kind of an expectation that is almost publisher driven in some cases as to, you know, it's a war game because it's published by GMT. And I don't really like the underlying, you know, assumptions that belong with that necessarily.
Well, there's also the other part of it too, where you could have like dudes on a map, you know, whether it's Battlecry or Memoir 44 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Not a skirmish game, but a war game. Those games are war games. They're good entry war games to get people into playing war games because they're fairly simple. They're low complexity, low counter density, well, low miniature density, and they're real fun, easy to get on the table. When a wargamer looks at a war game, they're wanting the counters and they're wanting the 50 page rule book. They're wanting the complexity to be there to really try to not at all times, you know, 15, 20, 30, 40 page rule book, but you're looking for more complexity, more chrome, because you're trying to dig into that one specific battle or that one specific operation, so that way you can study it a little bit and try to, you know, vicariously live that experience that happened in the past with a historical battle and see if you could do better, and also at the same time learn, and maybe by your reading say, hey, you know, he could have done this, historians say he should have done this, let me try it, see if it happens.
Part of that gets back to what's the intent with which I'm sitting down to play. And so that, you know, again, now we're trying to overlay people's intentions on what it is that we're trying to do with the game. And that gets real dicey when you're starting to try and sort of put some definitional boundaries around things, which is kind of what we were intending to sort of take some stabs at tonight. And ultimately, to me, it comes back to where I kept coming back to, you know, a game in which the primary path to victory is through military action, through military conflict. Like, you can't play an ASL game without a military conflict involved. But beyond that, once we start looking beyond sort of the obvious targets, what do we come up with? And the metaphor I've used, and I think I mentioned this one on the Charlies, I know I've used it once or twice on other podcasts before, but for folks that don't want to have to go digging through the archives, back when I taught my media and culture class in college, when I used to have that class to teach, one of the things we would do in the first night of class is we'd spend some time trying to define the words media and culture as we were going to use them in that classroom. And the culture one's not relevant for this, for the example, but the media example, okay, guys, let's start talking about when you think of media, what do you think of? And the obvious things were out there, right? Radio, television, newspapers, book publishing. But then we started to get a little further off of those couple of answers. Internet newsletters, do those count as media? I can subscribe to the Washington Post newsletter and get the headlines every morning, and I think everybody would consider that an extension of the media. But if the form factor is the same with Mo sitting down and writing out the weekly wargaming headlines and just emailing some stuff around, or just, you know, hey, here's 10 things I thought were kind of cool this week, and just emailing that to a dozen friends, does that cross the threshold into media?
If you post it on social media, it does.
Well, maybe. Yeah. But again, this goes back to us having the difficulty in discussing and describing those, trying to get our arms around this thing. Sure. And so, you know, greeting cards. I can walk into Target and go buy greeting cards. Those things all crank off a mass printing press, and I've got a ton of happy birthday grandma greeting cards. Well, if my kids sit down and make a couple of homemade greeting cards and say happy birthday grandma, are they now part of the media? And so the point of all that was that the center mass of the target is pretty clear, right? We all know what the middle of the target looks like. The further you get from the middle of the target, the fuzzier the lines start to get. And you start getting into places where now people are making some judgment calls. Is this in or is this out? And I think that's where those fuzzy lines were, to bring it back around to the start of our discussion. I think that was where some of the heartburn around the Charlies came from. And Mo, you and I have talked about this a little bit. But if you, wherever you draw the line, somebody is going to argue about it. And that's fine. We're wargamers. We argue. That's what we do. But when you don't draw a line, you now leave open the option for everybody else to impose their own lines on your decisions. And without having those lines on your decisions, people are left with way more room to argue about things. And so where that target starts to get fuzzier the further out you go, at some point you have to draw your own line around it and say, all right, that's the limit. Now, other people are going to have a different limit, and that's fine. But I think going back to something like the Charlies, or when I was an academic working on research projects, you got to draw a line somewhere so that other people assessing your work know where your boundaries were. Again, they can have their own definition. That's fine. Go do your own work with your definition. But what I'm describing is this. I'm going up to this point. I'm not crossing it. And I think that was part of what was missing from the Charlies this year, as we've discussed ad nauseum. And so with all of that babbling there, Mo, take it away.
Well, you're right. When it comes to the Charlies, obviously the big, sticking point for everybody was U-boat. And the problem with that one was there was no clear definition of what's a war game, what's not a war game. And because it was published in 2019 and it was the 2019 awards, it got put in there. And then Phalanx went out on their Kickstarter and they said, hey, go vote for us in all these categories we're in. And they won. And that's why I said it on Whiskey Charlie that, there needs to be oversight. And this is why, because some sort of oversight would have said, hey, wait a minute, is this really a war game or is it a strategy game? That's something that they would have to, that oversight body would have to determine. And then from there, you can allow it in or put it in a different category, whether it's a strategy game or historically themed game or whatever, which is where I personally think it would have been a better fit than a war game.
Yeah.
Because it's really a Euro with a war theme on it. And when you have a game that is, centered around orders, limited amount of orders that you have to give, which is just a worker placement game at that point, it changes the complexion of it. It's not a war game at that point, even though it does have a simulation aspect with the app. So it's one of those things where, again, it really needed oversight.
And really, I can already, we're not going to publish this for another 10 days, and I can already hear Harold yelling at the podcast. And that's fine. Like, Harold, I love you. That's fine. That's totally cool. Like, but part of that is Harold's got a different definition for war game than I think you and I are going to bring to the table. And I would hazard to guess that Ian is going to bring to the table that Harold is operating on a more expansive definition. That's totally cool. And so when Harold is talking about war games, as long as, he sort of says, when I talk about war games, this is what I'm referring to, then we all understand that he has a broader perspective than we might. And so again, I don't care where people decide to draw the line, but in a case like the Charlies or any other award or any other broader definition around the wargaming world, if you're saying, hey, we're doing this for wargaming, give me the boundaries of what you consider to be wargaming. And then I understand, because then it's going to save us all some headache of, yes, this is in, no, this is out. For me, going back to my definition of one, a game in which the primary path to victory is military conflict, U-boat is straight out. Right. There's no actual military conflict going on. The way you win is not by killing other people, right? Or seizing ground or whatever.
No, but you can lose by running out of orders and making your morale go down. And, because you don't effectively use your workers and their morale can go down and you can just be out of it from that. So that's an aspect of, and plus the other issues were things like the rule book and stuff that, again, an oversight committee or board or whatever would have known or hopefully known or would have been brought to their attention that, hey, this should definitely not be in for best rule book because the rule book was a mess and so on and so forth. But that's a whole nother, conversation. Yeah. But it does go to show that that's where the definitions need to be in, and some oversight is definitely needed.
Yeah. And I don't want to just sit here and bang on the Charlies. Like, they were the genesis this conversation, but these are definitional discussions that I think are valid beyond just what happened with this one particular set of awards.
It's their first year back there's growing pains and hopefully there's lessons learned and we want to see them succeed. We're hoping they succeed. That's why we're having these conversations, because we care.
Ian, what do you think?
Well, when I was getting ready for this podcast, I went through and I was trying to find all these definitions for war games. I sort of on a whim, I also went to look for a definition of a strategy game. Now, you think war games are hard to define. Don't even try to look at what a strategy game is.
A game with strategy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, some people say, well, tactics are not strategy, but we won't even go there. As I've been listening to this, and, you know, I started off with the very high level games are decisions and that sort of stuff. But what I was driving towards in sort of that is that calling a war game sort of physically what it is sometimes is helpful. And the war, you bet you're, I haven't told you what I think my definition is. I'll go ahead and I'll drop it now. I'm going to go all the way back to 1956. John Nash, Rand were sitting there talking about doing the internal war games. And in 56, they had an email exchange, and I really like what they came up with. And I think it really hits a lot of the points. It helps us include some things in and throw some things out. They said their definition was an imaginary military operation conducted upon a map or board, usually employing various movable devices, which are said to represent the opposing forces, which are moved according to rules representing conditions of warfare. The only thing that's missing out of there for me is some sort of an adjudication, a randomizer. But if you look at their actual games that they had dice. They had a CRT. They had a way of, you know, rules for adjudicating the combat. And when that's from 1956. And actually, I still like it. I like it for today because it does fit that imaginary military operation. That rules in, rules out a lot of pieces. It can be historical. It can be hypothetical. There are sci-fi war games out there. Mm-hmm. Map or board. You can stretch that definition. I'd say something like tank duel with the tableaus in front of you is still a map or board. The map's sort of in your head, but you have the tableau in front of you substituting for the board. Movable devices. Yeah, you don't always need to be in tank duel. You don't necessarily move anything on the table. You're moving some chits around in your tableau, but most times you do have pawns, movers, chits, dudes on a map, something out there representing your forces. And then they have to move in according to rules. And those rules represent conditions of the technical definition said actual warfare, but sometimes you don't know what actual warfare is. You're doing some hypothesizing here. Sci-fi war game. I don't think we can say how that's really actual warfare, but that's a game. This is how things could be. That's the more definition that I think helps us get someplace. And actually, I don't think it's really that far from you as you have, Mo. It's military. Mm-hmm. It's got pieces, the combat, and it represents something, really the martial side of it.
Yeah, you know, like you have scenarios, and in those scenarios, you have objectives. There may even be subordinate objectives that will give you the purpose of movement and combat in the game itself that you'll have to get from point A to point B and take point B as an objective. But to do so, you got to do it in a military manner using counters that are representative of different units that are, if it's modern or, you know, ancient or not ancient, but if it's historical in any way, they've, you know, broken down those units mathematically to represent offensive and defensive capabilities, movement as well. And then you have to also move on the map using the terrain effects chart that is going to give you the different types of the terrain, the modes of movement, how much it's going to cost you to move, and any types of effects on the units in combat. And all of these, you know, are going to be following rules out of their framework that allow all these components to come together that form the simulation and or model, if you want to call it that, that the game represents. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about there. It's just we're kind of just dissecting it, not dissecting it, but rewording the same stuff. I think that's a great definition. Yes. That you're using.
I just, without having a specific counterpoint to argue with any of the components of the RAND definition, I still just have this kind of aversion to the fact that it's primarily describing form factor as opposed to function. And that still in the back of my mind kind of bugs me, even if I can't point my finger at specifically why I don't like a particular part of that definition.
The function, though, is all the individual pieces coming together to work towards one goal of simulating or whatever the model is.
Yeah. No. I mean, I get all that, but you know, I'm trying to think of ways in which to apply those rules to, you know, again, let's actually test them against a particular game here or there. And so, Ian, I'm hoping that, you know, you've either got the RAND definition committed well enough to memory or a copy in front of you that we can sort of go through itemized point by itemized point. But I'm obviously like ASL got it. checks all those boxes, right? I mean, we're not really missing much there. Risk is going to check all those boxes, right? We're not really missing much there either, are we?
Right. Military, imaginary military operation, map, movable pieces, rules of warfare. Yes.
Yeah. So let's grab up front, because that's the one that people love to start pulling out when we start talking about these things. What happens with the map for up front? Is there enough of a map with up front to really work? It's abstracted out through the use of some particular cards that become notional terrain over which you're operating, but it's still very notional. And is that enough of a map that we're comfortable screening up front in using that RAND definition?
So that would then revolve around, what is your definition of the map or board? Is the theater of the mind, like what happens in Tank Duel or up front, sufficient to be your map? Yeah. I would say yes, because there is still creating a space, be it a hex map or be it a cards invoking some imagination. There is a space over which the battle is being, the conflict is being fought. So I would say yes.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
I would say yes. It does have now movable devices, which instead of represent opposing forces, could that be cards? Maybe. But again, you're even if it's the theater of the mind, you're moving pieces about in accordance to the rules that are doing warfare. So I think we're pushing the edges right away. Yes. But I don't think we're screening it out automatically.
But those cards are representing pieces of terrain or bits of terrain, correct? In up front.
In up front, yes, there are cards that represent terrain. But
so essentially, it's a randomized area movement map.
Yeah. So now I'm going to push that boundary one further, and this is where the whole theater of the mind part starts to make my hair stand on end a little bit.
RPG.
Well, no, not the RPG. So Byron Collins has the Spearpoint 43 games out there that are. It's a bit of a deck building game, but it is World War II combat. It is tanks and planes and artillery pieces and infantry squads, and there's no map over which you're fighting. Now, it's pre-constructed decks, so it's not a collectible game like Magic the Gathering. It is pre-constructed decks. Everything comes out of the box. You build your decks according to a certain amount of points, and then you're fighting through your decks of cards. There is no terrain out there at all. It is simply a shootout between the two sides. And so, again, you know, going back to the definition that I was working from of, you know, game in which primary path to conflict, you know, to victory is military conflict, it still fits in that box. But I think we're starting to get kind of further afield from the RAND definition. And to take it a step even further beyond that, back in the early 90s, you had the Echelons of Fire, Echelons of Fury collectible card games. You had the Last Crusade collectible card game. You had a variety of these military-themed collectible card games that, again, no map at all, no pawns or pieces that you're moving around. You know, again, do we want to use the deployment of the cards on the table from hand to hand as the movement of those pawns and pieces? I mean, I guess we could, but that almost seems to me,
Brant,
to be.
You answered your own question. You just called them military themed collectible card game. You didn't call them a war game.
Well, I would call them a war game, though. That's the thing. To me, those were war games. And I was calling them military themed collectible card games to kind of draw that distinction from what you had with the RAND stuff, because I do think that those fall into the war game category, but I'm not sure they pass the RAND definition.
Yeah, but the whole thing is when you add in the term collectible card game, that's a whole another rabbit hole to go down, because it's a money pit right there just to get in the collectible card game.
Yeah, the marketing piece of it aside, right? Yeah. And this is why I start to have some trouble with the form factor piece of it, because Byron's Spearpoint card game, it's not collectible. It's straight out of the box. You know, here are your decks you can play. Now, he does have some expansions for them, and he does have an expansion that explicitly puts map tiles out there that now you start to introduce some things like line of sight, terrain costs, and whatever. That's a separate expansion, but just straight out of the box, it's like two and a half oversized decks. The cards are regular size. The decks are thickable. So it's, you know, 100 odd cards in a box, and you build your force on either side, and you sit there and have a fight.
That's really more of a skirmish game. than it is necessarily a straight up war game, which a lot of people do feel skirmish games are war games because of the battle aspect of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that I've got any way to screen out Byron's Spearpoint card game without, you know, it feels to me that starts to run afoul of the RAND definition. And again, this is where I think a lot of great definitions, we come up with a lot of really good ideas for some definitions in the abstract, but then, all right, now let's apply some practical examples to it. And that's where some of the guys that start to pull out some of the, you know, the air quotes around traditional war games, right? Leaping Lemmings gets screened in and it's a fun game. It's a blast to play. I don't know if you guys have ever played it. It's one of Rick Young's games published by GMT. You're trying to run your lemmings through these fields where there's a couple of eagles circling. You want to not get caught by the eagles. You want to get your lemmings off to the cliff, and you want to have the biggest possible leap off the cliff with your lemmings. That's how you score extra points. And what is kind of fun is the different tribes of lemmings, like all the different characters are named after the playtesters. Nice. Like there's a lemming in there named after Ray Farrell, right? I mean, there's all these different lemmings running around in there. And it's a fun game. It's a blast. And any war gamer is going to look at that and go, oh, I know what to do with this, right? It's a hex map. The eagles each circle their own zones that have these expanded zones of control. There's terrain because the lemmings are hiding under the bushes to stay away from the eagles, to break line of sight. There's movement allowances. Like there's all of this stuff that as war gamers, we're going, yeah, I get how this works.
Yeah.
It's not working. Is that a problem? Right? No. And as a game, it's a perfectly fun game. But again, you know, we start to say, what are those definitions? What gets screened in and what gets screened out? I almost wonder if Leaping Lemmings under the RAND definition doesn't get screened into being a war game.
You could call it a war game and have it something like that based on the theme alone would sound more like a light war game, a fun party war game almost.
Yeah.
But is that a war game?
Yeah, exactly.
But is that necessarily what we want in the group hug of war gaming?
Well,
And that's part of the question. We might not. Those are some of the questions I think are the point of this conversation. I think those are some of the questions the guys from the Charlies didn't ask themselves, but I think they're valid questions all along the way. So under the RAND definition, does U-boat get screened in or screened out, guys? What do you think?
Out.
So is it an imaginary military operation?
It is set in a U-boat, but the premise of the game is really management of your crew. More so, I mean, there is a simulation aspect of it, but the meat and potatoes of the game is all about managing your crew with limited orders. So that makes it more worker placement than it does a combat driven, because if you don't have enough orders to give your guy, then you have to go over the, I think it's a 3-order limit, I think is what you get, then you're going to start hurting their morale. Just like if you don't feed them what they want to eat, then their morale goes down. There's a lot of the game, most of the game seems to be spent on that more than fighting your ship, which is to me what would be the definition of a war game.
I'd agree with you, Mo.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think one easy test with U-boat is, instead of placing it in a conflict theme of, you know, I've got a U-boat that's hunting merchant vessels or whatever, if this is a research sub trying to dive to the bottom of the Marianas Trench, does the game change at all? And I don't think so.
No.
So you know, that first question of, is it, you know, an imaginary military conflict? Maybe, but even so, that is irrelevant to the play of the game, and I don't know how much that makes a difference.
It's a military conflict setting. It definitely is a setting and theme, but that's not the primary driver. Just like if you want to say that's a war game, then okay, you want to play a game of Kanban as like, are we simulating building cars or are we just playing a worker placement Euro? You know, it depends on how you want to split hairs on it. But, you know, when the primary driver of the game is your order system and having to deal with fewer orders than you normally would have. I mean, we all know that on any vessel, in this instance, a U-boat, as a commander, you're going to tell these guys what to do. They're going to do it. You're not going to have, oh, you know what? You only get 3 commands today, sir. You cannot tell me to do a 4th one, because if you do, I'm going to be really sad and I'm not going to load that torpedo.
Well, I mean,
the Navy recently.
Well, the Dutch military is maybe.
Well, look, the Dutch military is unionized. They may have limits as to what you can get away with them.
United sub workers.
Yeah. All right. So let's keep working through this, Randa. Obviously, I mean, we've already hit a snag right there on the first one, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So what, what's
conducted
next?
Upon a map or board.
There is no.
This map. Is where I'm going to edit in the snippet of Jim Ozarski yelling, "It doesn't have a map.
U-boat doesn't have a map."
There is no map in it. There is a.
But there is
sub.
A board.
There is a board. There's a sub, which is basically how you track where your workers are going. The map per se would be a sheet of paper. There is a sheet of paper that you use for tracking targets. So in that instance, yeah, I guess you could say there's a map, and that is definitely not map of the year. But that is just one of the components of the game. It's not like there's one specific map that you play on.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable with that because I'm thinking of another game, Tank Duel, which does not have a hex map, but it does have the tableaus, and you have on the tableaus, you're at least tracking, you know, relative ranges between, you know, nearer, farther, that sort of stuff, which sounds a lot like what they did in U-Boat. So I'd say, okay, yeah, okay. It meets the second part of the definition. The next part.
I was going to say, I would agree with you just because I think the sub itself becomes the board on which you're doing these things. So I don't have a problem checking it off with that one.
Next, usually employing various movable devices which are said to represent the opposing force.
No, that's all handled by the application that you use in the game.
So the question is, are we just not caught up? Is our definition not caught up with technology?
Possible. I mean, like the random... not random, but the contacts that you get are all app driven and you have to try to plot them from there, you know, based on the movement on that little map that I was talking about before. That's the other portion of it where you try to plot their movement, and that way you plot an intercept and you try to engage it. So that is the simulation aspect of the game, which I think the game would have been better off if it just concentrated on that and left the Euro stuff aside, because then it would have been a war game for sure. But yeah, the when it comes to that, that's all driven by the application itself. There is no, you know, opposing player.
Is there a way to I'm trying to think of a good way to express this that I don't have to edit myself later. But I guess the part of the question is it. Going back to Rand is writing this in 1954 or whenever it was, is there a way in which those opposed forces, right, the merchant ships that you're hunting or whatever it is, that those could have been somehow represented or replicated without having an app on your phone? You know, is there?
Well, certainly, you know, they could have done it the old Avalon Hill submarine way and done a hex map with it right there in front of you.
Yeah.
I'm an old Navy guy and My kids were sitting here the other day. I pulled out a Mo board. No, Mo, you're not bored. but a maneuvering board.
Yeah.
If you do ship navigation, you're at the center of the board and you plot out where the other pieces are and you figure out, hey, okay, constant bearing, decreasing range, we're on a collision course, or it's crossing. You can figure out speed and distance and all that sort of stuff from it. If they had done something like that, yeah, okay, it's more navigation, but something like that, it would have been, I think, a lot more fun in the fact that it's at least it's trying to represent what you would actually have to do there, plotting out where you are. That would have gotten us a lot closer to the definition of a war game too. You'd have a map that you're playing it out on, a board, in this case a maneuvering board.
Yeah, my gut reaction is I'm prepared to give the Rand guys a bit of a mulligan for the fact that the technology has evolved since they wrote this. I think that there's probably a way in which you could have figured out to represent the movement of these other dudes, you know, your targets or whatever, without the use of the technology, had the technology not existed and that had been the only way to do it. I don't know that the game would have been it obviously changes some of the character of the game, because now the fog of war starts to dissipate a little more. But I'm kind of willing to give the Rand guys a bit of a mulligan on that, knowing full well that, you know, just from criteria one, I think we've already screened it out of the war game pool.
Well, the last part, I think also it's going to help us here, is that the forces are moved according to rules representing conditions of actual warfare. I think we get right into what Mo was talking about. It's a worker placement game. I mean, is that actual warfare? Or is that even actual representing actual life?
That
you only get three moves? No.
Yeah, I think at that point we've definitely screened it out some. So I think, you know, the Rand definition, again, not saying that you have to agree or disagree with the Rand definition, but at least there we've got a definition against which to compare these things, right?
Agreed.
And now, now we've got something to consider as a part of that. And so I think that that starts to become hugely important. I think also, you know, when we start to look at some of the other pieces of this, you know, if we're going to run with the RAND definition, do minis war games fit into that RAND definition? I think they do. I don't know that there's a whole lot of question that we're going to be able to check off all those boxes, are we?
I'd say I for one, do not understand this distinction between minis and board war game.
Hang out with the minis guys for a while. They'll make sure you do.
I know. I see it all the time. I mean, I love Little Wars TV, but they just want to be special.
I'm with you. I don't know that there's a sufficient definition. So...
The financial investment they've got in it. That's what it is. That's why they feel special. We go spend $100 on a game. They spend $100 on an army or part of an army. And then $800 later, they've got enough to field the whole battle.
Yes. Without the terrain.
Yeah, exactly. That's a whole nother cost all on its own.
Yeah. Now, Ian, I'm with you in that I don't know that I necessarily see the necessity of drawing those distinctions other than the fact that I want to make sure that we do address both in our conversation so that one side or the other doesn't accuse us of neglecting them in favor of the other one. I do think that there are distinctions in the kinds of people that play the two different types of games. And again, I know that because I've got the research actually to show that. But I think for our purposes, especially today, I don't know that there are any real distinctions of note that need to be considered there.
No, so, I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah. I did want to make sure we at least asked the question so that if any minis guys are listening to this later, they can go, well, what about us? Well, we're including you too.
Yeah. They're war games too.
You're part of the group hug. It's okay.
They just use miniatures instead of counters, and they use really cool 3D terrain instead of a flat map.
Again, let's go back to the RAND definition just to compare and see. I don't want to go to the coin games. What about Root?
I've never heard of Root.
How does Root compare against the RAND? Is this a war game test?
So the first part of the RAND test is an imaginary military operation.
Well, it's imaginary because isn't it a fight between forest animals?
It's woodland animals.
Yeah. It's woodland animals. Yeah. And there is fighting.
There's some imagination necessary. Yeah. Either that or some solid hallucinogenics.
And everything I've heard, like, it's funny. You said you didn't want to go down the coin route, but everything I've heard about Root is it's a coin game. In essence.
Absolutely.
So
it's a political game.
Well, but you can sit here and make the argument that the coin games are political games, right?
Well, they are. They definitely have a political component.
Yes.
Yeah. So this goes back to
imaginary military operations.
Yep.
I think yes. Whether they really want to admit it or not, it comes down to fighting and control over different clearings in the forest, and the way you do that is by literally moving influence or control through soldiers, or through the influence mechanism if you're a woodland alliance, to control the map. So it's military. Even the woodland alliance has their rebellion and the different rules that they flip the attack dice. It conducted upon a map or board. Beautiful illustrated boards.
Yep.
So say movable devices, which are said to represent the opposing forces. Very cute cats. Yes.
Yep.
And moved according to rules representing conditions of actual warfare. Well, they give us the rules for warfare, at least the woodland rules for warfare. So I'd say yes.
I wonder how the rest of the world's going to react to us now classifying Root as a war game.
Well, I think I have no problem with it.
Yeah.
It's a war game. And just because it has cuter components, and just because it has, you can sit down with your little fuzzy meeple, doesn't make it anything less of a war game. It makes it a cute war game.
Yes.
But it's still, and even I kill myself for using the word cute, because it is a vicious war game. when you play Root and you play it, you get a four way going. It's a vicious game, and it's
amongst
just as
cute critters.
As it's, well, you know what? Rabies is real. and I see it in Root.
Every time I hear people talk about Root, the first thing that comes to my mind is that what should be the soundtrack to that game is The Trees by Rush.
Ooh.
If anybody knows that song, yes. It's like it's perfectly fitting. It's just the trees having the same kind of fight, the maples, the oaks, and everything, with having this battle this similar to what we are hearing in Root, just a lot less cute because the little animals are really cute.
And the challenge with this is I can't edit in a snippet of the trees because I don't want to run afoul of a copyright claim trying to, you know, trying to. So kids, look at it. I'll link to the video on YouTube. Kids, go look it up. So I say kids, go look it up. I don't imagine there are too many wargamers that aren't old enough to know who Rush is. So, you know.
Well, my kids don't know. I've tried to teach them.
I was going to say, I think there's an educational gap we've now identified.
I've tried to teach them.
This is what we call the teaching moment.
Yes. Yes. Let me ask a question. Gut reaction, is diplomacy a wargame?
It's a lose your friends game.
Well, yeah. There's certainly some interpersonal warfare going on there.
Well, politics is warfare, you know, is warfare too, because war is politics by other means, as von Clausewitz said, you know. So I would say politics is warfare. It's probably the foulest, nastiest type of warfare there is, because it's all about backstabbing and promising and lying constantly to people, to their face. Whereas at least two guys that are in uniform are, it's more straight up. They both know what they're doing and what they're fighting for. Politics, I think, is a different animal altogether. But diplomacy, I don't think I'd classify it as a warfare game, a war game, but I would say it's a hostile game, that's for sure.
Well, yeah,
the first part of the definition says imaginary military operation. It is just the political competition between nations, a military operation. I'm going to say it goes beyond the military operation. It brings in so much more.
But here's the challenge with diplomacy,
though. It's a factor, yes, but it's not a military operation game.
But here's the challenge, though, with diplomacy specifically, and this is why I brought it up. Diplomacy is always one of those ones that, depending on where you draw the line, gets either screened in or screened out. The issue with diplomacy is, what are the actual assets at your disposal as the player? There's your own personal, interpersonal communication ability in terms of your ability to bluff folks and read folks and know when to double cross them and when to go with the group and when to lay low and when to make a big move and all that, right? There's all that social gameplay that is exactly the same as Survivor. But the actual assets and tools that you have to manipulate in the game itself, in diplomacy, armies and navies, and that is it. You have no economic tools at your disposal. You have no propaganda tools at your disposal. You have no, you know, going back to Ian, the article you had written about South China Sea, the dime paradigm. Mm-hmm. The D is represented by the player and the M is represented by the pieces on the board. You don't have the E and you don't have the I in there at all. And so while it's not a specific military operation, the only assets you have at your disposal in that game are your military ones, are your armies and navies.
So is that just poor design?
I think it's an intentional design.
It's sacrilege to say diplomacy and say poor design in the same sentence. I understand. Yeah. But I think when it comes to a war game definition, I think it strays far enough away. Yes, you have military pieces in there, but at the end of the day, it strays far enough away because it's not focusing on military operations. The focus is the politics, the international relations as represented by the players in their countries.
That would be more of a conflict simulation if you want to use a fancy term, another fancy term that sounds
isn't that Harold's term?
Yeah, well, it is one of the terms that is used, but I think it does have a place.
Yeah, that's a Dunnigan term, because Dunnigan had it in the Complete War Games Handbook, which is, you know, the use of the term conflict simulation avoids the two ugly terms of war and game. The problem with that is, and I've made this point repeatedly over the years, not all conflicts are wars, and games and simulations are used interchangeably, and they're not the same thing. Now, there are games that can be simulations, but there are simulations that are not games, and there are games that are not simulations. Tic-tac-toe ain't simulating a damn thing. And there are flight simulators that, you know, or Mo, you learned to drive a tank in the tank simulator, didn't you?
Nope. Did the old-fashioned way.
You did the old-fashioned way?
Yeah.
So when I was at Fort Knox, early 90s, they had tank driver simulators that it was just the tank crewman's seat, and it was up on this six-way pneumatic thing. And it's funny, they actually had barf bags in there for people that couldn't handle the pneumatic movement real well, because some people, you know, with the visuals and you know, the pneumatic movement, but the inner ear not necessarily matching what the eye is giving them, like they go into overload and they end up throwing up. I fortunately am not one of those people.
It's like being seasick.
I thought the simulator was a blast, but you can do something very similar on a desktop computer. Like there are flight simulators that aren't games. They just go fly a plane around and go see mm-hmm. cool things, and that's fine. And you know, that's fun for some people. There are other people that want to use flight simulators to have races with each other, and that's cool. Now you've overlaid an external condition. Now it's a game because you're actually racing each other. Mm-hmm. But there are simulators that there are simulations that are not games. There are games that are not simulations. And so to simply assume that you can swap out war game for conflict simulation, like they are synonyms and not identical terms for a reason. And that's where I have a hard time using conflict simulation as a euphemism for war game.
Well,
because
yeah,
it fundamentally changes what you're talking about.
It does. But at the same time, you know, it goes back to that thing about politics being like war, a form of warfare. And like Churchill, for example, that's not a war game. That would be, at least me, I would consider that more of a conflict simulation, because you're simulating the meetings and the conflict of the back and forth struggle, that seesaw, that tug of war, I should say,
yeah.
of trying to get your things won over while you're abstractly fighting the war.
Yeah. And there's no shortage of those kinds of games. Fort Sumter is out there now.
Yeah.
One could argue Pericles is like that.
Yeah.
There are plenty of those. Quite frankly, I dump Twilight Struggle into the conflict simulation bucket, mm-hmm. but would not put it in the war game bucket. And again, well, like,
yeah,
you know, the voice from the future, Harold, yelling at us, what's the matter with you guys?
Well, conflict simulation is considered another term for war game. So I've said that before. I think Twilight Struggle is a conflict simulation. Conflict simulation is another way of looking, another term for war game. So technically you could say Twilight Struggle is a war game.
Yeah. But, and that's where I think the two of us are going to come to some disagreement, because
no. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those terms where, I mean, it's one of those things where it doesn't matter. It's a great game and people love it. And
oh yeah.
If it's a game that introduces people and they say, hey, I want to, what's next? Well, hey,
exactly.
These ones out, you know, and that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. I want to make sure that we're clear that we're not making qualitative judgments on things
no.
that we are saying are not war games. There's absolutely nothing saying they aren't good games.
Nope.
Seven Wonders is one of my favorite games of all time. It is not a war game. You can win that game going away and get your ass kicked militarily by not even engaging in military conflict for the entire game and win that one going away. So this is not a qualitative thing at all. We're simply trying to figure out, all right, so what is a war game?
It goes back to one of the things I said to you the other day. I says, you know, when it comes to war games and conflict simulations and stuff like that, it's like, okay, well, you take an 18XX game, you take Ticket to Ride. Technically, they're both train games. You say that to a train gamer, they're going to say, that's not a train game.
Yeah. Well, and again, depending on how you define the train games, there was a game that was intended as sort of this abstract it's tough to say educational, but that was really the point. It wasn't to teach you about trains, but it was the game was called Train. I think it was just called Train, but it was about sort of maximizing passenger capacity as you are moving your trains around. The whole point was it was a teaching point about the trains that were used in the Holocaust.
Mm.
Depending on where you draw the lines on train games, that's a game featuring trains at the center of it all, about moving cargo capacity around. Do you really want to screen that in with your 18XX games?
No,
probably not.
I don't think too many people are going to want to play that just for the
no,
team
and
that kills
and
it. Yeah,
it, yeah, and that's the whole point, is that it's the game that you play once. You know,
yeah.
It's sort of, once you've figured out what's going on and you've absorbed the lesson of, oh crap, this sucks, then you've kind of had that teaching point. But again, this goes back to sort of the difference between the professional games and the hobby games. The hobby games are playing for fun. That one ain't intended to be played for fun. That there's a very definite specific teaching point underneath that one that the designers built into there. So again, probably doesn't fit in that same category of Ticket to Ride in the 18XX games. But again, where do you draw the lines? And then once you have a set of lines drawn, I think what you've got to do is you've got to grab a bunch of examples and let's throw them out there and let's see what you come up with. Ian, going back to your RAND definition, that very first one, that real or imagined military conflict, what was the exact wording?
An imaginary military operation.
Imaginary military operation.
Upon that.
Okay.
Right.
So I think imaginary military operation, obviously expansive enough to include Cold War hypotheticals. I think we've treated that definition as expansive enough to cover fuzzy critters in the woods for something like Root. I think the three of us at least would probably consider it expansive enough that if we pulled out the old D&D module X10, the red arrow black shield, is it black arrow or red shield, whichever one it is, that was the actual war game set in the world of Mystara. You've got orcs versus elves versus humans versus whatever. It's still a military conflict, right? I mean, I think the RAND definition is sufficiently broad to cover that, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be?
I've never played that scenario, but possibly. I mean, if you want to go down that line, RPGs, RPGs came out of skirmish games.
Well, RPGs have a very specific mechanic that helps define them uniquely as RPGs, and that's the idea of character progression, right? So this is a traveling, widely recognized thing within the
role-playing aspect.
Say that again, Mo.
Aside from the role-playing aspect, because I don't think there's too many wargamers sitting down wearing military uniforms of whatever side they're playing as and talking with those accents. I mean, some people do it as a joke, but they're not like actually trying to be that whichever leader it is from that side.
Yeah, they're not trying to inhabit that persona. And then the other piece, mm-hmm. obviously, with the wargaming or with the role-playing world is the sort of one person, one character kind of thing is sort of the expected standard there. But, the role-playing world has the very specific and intentionally unique condition of the idea of character progression. People get better over time at the things that they do or later degrade over time, as age and wear and tear start to kick in. And that's not something that we see built into most war games. You could make an argument for like a campaign kind of game like Lock and Load's Drive on Giessen, where you sort of bring back the same forces from scenario to scenario. But really, those forces don't seem – I haven't seen any war games that build in like the qualitative improvement in the forces from battle to battle. It's just sort of, okay, you've now got these additional assets or you've lost these going from one to the other.
Yeah.
Not necessarily that they get better as they go, but they also tend to fail that sort of one, that single person scale that the role playing games live off of.
Yeah, not only that they gain experience and get better, but the wear and tear in the vehicles, fatigue, and things like that would be cool to model in a campaign. But that's kind of going sideways on the. On a tangent there, but that is true.
So, again, this gets back to sort of what are the lines that you decide to draw and what are the ones that you come up with and let's whatever lines you come up with, like then you got to test them. Like let's grab some examples and see what happens. Supply lines, of the American Revolution. Does that pass the RAND test?
Imaginary military operations. It's the Revolutionary War.
Yeah.
On a map.
Yep.
Yes. Movable devices representing opposing forces.
Yes.
Are they representing rules, opposing forces?
Cubes are aren't they representing, if I remember correctly, the supplies?
You have chits that are the Americans and the British.
Yeah, and then the cubes
but
are the
chits, the cubes are also supplies that they're fighting over, the competition over.
Yeah, and they're using to fight as well.
Yes.
Just making sure that we're explicitly clear for anybody in the audience that doesn't necessarily know the game.
Yeah, no, there are counters that's right. There are counters.
The counters and leaders.
Forces. Yeah.
The counters and leaders.
Yeah.
The forces and leaders. Moved according to rules representing conditions of warfare.
Yep.
Yep.
All righty. So, we could do four shows on just comparing games against these definitions. The supply lines for me, I think is one of those edge cases that depending on how you measure the military conflict as the primary path to victory, supply lines starts to become one of those really close edge cases according to the definition that I've been using for the last several years. And that starts to get a little tougher. Whereas I think Hollenspiel's table battles very clearly is in on my definition, but might be a little closer on the RAND one because it doesn't have a map. It's got the cards that are representing the units, but there's no real spatial relationship that's a primary driving factor.
Yeah, you're back to spear point 43.
I'm back to spear point. Yeah. It's a little different with table battles because table battles does have the table laid out there in front of you with the units represented individually and distinctly in their stacks where you can pick and choose, okay, I need that unit for this action kind of a thing, where spear point, you're sort of limited to what's in your hand. So that's, but again, we're off to all those edge cases, but it's those edge cases that I think start to trip people up. And that's why you've got half of the community out there going, U-boat's not a war game. And you've got the other half of the community going, yes, it is.
I'd like to meet the half of the community that says, yes, it is. And ask them, are you really war gamers or are you just playing strategy game?
I think a big part of that is because of the history, you know, behind it. It's got a big U-boat on the cover and it says U-boat. But here's the operative piece of this. On the cover, it says U-boat, the board game, not U-boat, the war game. So the game itself is even admitting it's not technically a war game.
Yeah. Is that a marketing thing though?
I don't know. That's what the title of the game is.
Yeah. Because, I mean, the Stratego guys, let's face it, Stratego's a war game. But if you read the rules for Stratego, like one of the first things in the rule book is, this is not a war game. This is, you know, abstract representational military themes, something, something. It's like, dude, seriously, like quit trying to appease all the peacenik moms out there. This is a war game. Just
it's
quit
the
pretending
fear
otherwise.
Of using that term, which is ridiculous.
Exactly. It's absolutely a war game, and there's no other real way around it. We're 90 minutes into this ish. Like by the time I edit it, it'll probably be about an hour 20 at this point. But we're 90 minutes into this, and have we actually come to any sort of conclusions? Mo, what do you think? Have we made much progress in all of this?
I think so. I think the RAND definition really is a good indicator of, at least a starting point, if not a really strong framework to build from and to judge games on. Now there's going to be edge cases. There's going to be some stuff where it's kind of a judgment call, which is going to be opinion driven. You know, like you may say that supply lines for you is an edge case. So it's kind of teetering on. It can go either way. Me, I go, yeah, it's a war game. You know, it's a war game. I'm not even going to think twice about it. Root, it's a war game, you know, from everything we talked about. I don't see any, you know, because primarily the goal in those games is a military style objective, if not an outright military objective. And it's done through combat is how you get to the objective. And if a game doesn't have that, then I think that takes it out of the war game realm. And that's where a U-boat is, like, we keep going back to U-boat, but it really is.
Well, there's the reason we keep going back to U-boat.
Yeah. I mean, everything is precipitated on the fact that you have to manage your crew, and that's done with limited orders, and it's worker placement. And that takes it out of being a war game when that's the primary function of the game.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think as much as anything, sort of thinking about it tonight, you know, when we were talking, when we were comparing U-boat up against that RAND definition, the fact that you could reskin it as a research sub and the game does not change, I think that right there kills it for me as much as anything. So, Ian, what do you think? Have we made a whole lot of progress here tonight?
I think what we've come down to is sort of what I started off at the beginning is I know a war game when I see it. I think you hit a good point, Mo, that people, you know, it's people's perceptions, maybe even their own biases. Why was Stratego, why did they call Stratego out and not say it's a, you know, why did they not want to call it a war game? Some people just don't want to play a war game, but they don't mind playing a strategy game that has high levels of conflict. It's sort of, if that's what it takes for you to play the game, well, then that's what it takes. I'm just really glad that we got away from, hey, it's got hexes, it's got a CRT. Those pieces, because unfortunately, I think that still sits out there. And it's pretty sad. I think that there's still people out there that take a look at the physical components, and judge a war game based upon just, oh, that's the way it looks. I'm thinking about one particular video that was taken down, by a very popular YouTube war game influencer.
Yeah,
we know which one.
Yeah.
When you start wanting to put stuff in a bucket because of those biases that you have, that's when I think we get into the most trouble. I think at the end of the day, you said it, Brent, it's if it's a good game, let's play it. And that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, I don't think anybody, certainly none of the three of us, and I don't imagine any of the podcast guests we've had this season, and quite frankly, I don't imagine hardly any of the audience for this podcast are going to think, you know, hey, it's a good game, but I'm not going to play it because it's not a war game. I don't know that that crosses any of our audience's mind. If it's a good game and they get an opportunity to play a good game, it doesn't matter how that game came about, who published it, what they did. Like, it's still a good game. Let's go have fun with a good game. If it's not a good game, why isn't it a good game? But usually if it's not a good game, we're not going to waste time playing it, no matter what kind of game it is.
You know, you hit on a good point. You hit on a good point right there. Before, I don't want that thought to leave my head because you just brought it up. But
yeah,
no one that we've talked to, you know, that you've talked to on your podcast is going to say, "Ah, oh, I'm not going to play that," you know, because it doesn't fit this definition, that definition. If it's a good game, I'm going to play it. Going back to what you said about Stratego, oh, it's not a war game. It's not a war game. War gamers are almost, it almost feels like we're always on the defensive, defending war games and trying to define it to fit it into a niche that, you know, makes everybody, that appeases everybody. No, a war game is a war game. Like it or not, that's what the game's all about.
Yeah.
Just like a Euro is a Euro, whatever. It seems like war gamers will play anything as long as it's fun, but people will shy away from war games because it says war game. There is a bias the other way that is never talked about. It always feels like the war gamers have to be defensive and defend our choice of game.
Yeah. Yeah. They're, and some of that emotional baggage is part of what Dunnigan was trying to get away from by pushing away from the term of war and game to use conflict and simulation. And we've already hashed that out earlier in the show, if they want to hear it again. But I think you're right that there does feel like there are a lot of occasions on which we are called upon to sort of justify our enjoyment of the games we play. And that may also be why some of the folks want to recategorize things for whoever they're talking to as, oh, no, these are historical board games. The challenge there is, you know, then you end up with Pandemic Rome winning the Origins Award for best historical board game, because it is a historical board game, but it's, you know, that's the strict constructionist definition of the words, not necessarily the way in which the euphemism was always represented over the years. And those things are going to change as the audience changes. Like, I got it. But, you know, for what we're trying to do with war games, I think ultimately where the definitions become relevant and valid and necessary is when we start trying to say, all right, we are doing X for wargaming, and therefore we are focusing on things that fit this definition, whether it's giving out an award, whether it's the games that we're trying to present to audiences at conventions, whether it's the topics of our podcasts, whatever it may be. If we're saying, hey, we talk war games, these are the things that we mean and why, as opposed to whatever those other topics are. One of the things that, so Armchair Dragoons, like, we're primarily a wargaming site, but I'm always careful to use the term primarily a wargaming site. If you look at the header of our site, it says we are the Regiment of Strategy Gaming. We are not just war game. We've recorded podcasts on 4X games, on space 4X games, on role-playing games. We've written articles about all of the above. One of our heaviest trafficked articles on our site is actually one about the old TSR Beckme rules series and the Mystara game world. I've mentioned before, I have no idea where all of this traffic is coming from that hits our site, but that's one of the most heavily trafficked pages that we have every month on our site. And it's not a war game. And I'm not going to pretend it's a war game. It's still stuff I enjoy. That's why I wrote about it. But it's not a war game. And while the Armchair Dragoons are primarily a wargaming site, we're running Kriegspiels through email for, you know, Jim ran one for 2.5 years, right? Who else out there has had a 2.5 year running game with 20 participants that had weekly turns rolling over, right? Damn. There's not that many of those folks out there. And we did. Jim drove that thing for 2 years and change. It was awesome. And that's next week's podcast. Actually, we're going to wrap up with those guys talking about it. We are focused on war games, but we're not exclusive to it. And that's why we've branded ourselves as the Regiment of Strategy Gaming. And that was intentional because we didn't want to be overly exclusionary, that when we did talk about role-playing games or 4X games, we didn't want people going, wait, you guys are supposed to be a wargaming site. What's the matter with you?
Traitors.
Yeah. We wanted to cover more ground. Mo, your show is Mo's Game Table, not Mo's War Game Table.
No, it's just Mo's Game Table. It's primarily war games, but you can tell by the header on the top of the channel, it's, you know, India, Pakistan, and next war, India, Pakistan. But I do cover other games on the channel as well. And as a matter of fact, this week I'm going to be covering another game, a historical board game, One Small Step, which is a Euro. It's a worker placement, but it is a history-based theme of the space race between the Soviets and the U.S. So,
and we've got a review of that coming up in the next couple of weeks also. We also today in our, as we're recording this, it's today, right? It's 10 days ago by the time you guys are listening to this, but in our Tuesday Newsday news dump, the video from Moe's Game Table that we called out was one of your Alien RPG videos.
Nice.
And so, you know, again, Moe's Game Table isn't Moe's War Game Table. You focus on war games, but that's not all you do. Mm-hmm. And if you had called yourself Moe's War Game Table and somebody, you know, tried to throw a flag at you for covering Alien, they would be right to do so.
Yeah.
So can't really blame them. Ian, right, Rocky Mountain Navy, you got you're covering all kinds of stuff. But again, you're not
board gaming, role playing game. Yeah.
Yes. And you're not defining yourself as anything to the contrary. Gary, no. Aardwolf's Lair. there's no attempt to define what kinds of games he's covering. So again, there is usefulness for the definitions when put in the appropriate places. I think we can all agree to that. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably, and we know some of these guys, there are probably some of these dudes that want to use it as a cudgel to sort of beat on people when they don't need to. And those guys are just annoying, right? Let's just all admit it. Those guys are kind of annoying. But I think there's some validity to an appropriate time at which you can and should use those definitions. And I think that's sort of what I at least was hoping we were going to get to some of tonight. So.
Yeah, I think we did. And, you know, but again, it goes back to the RAND definition. I think that's a great, you know, foundation to work with, because that will give you most of the way for games. You know, some of these games are like, well, it covers most of it. It's not too far of a stretch from the other definitions. So, yeah, this is a war game. You know, it's you have to have something to base it off of. And again, when it goes back to the Charlies, it just comes down to, I think, just some oversight. And again, first year back, hopefully it'll be lessons learned and they'll improve next year.
Ian, last word is yours before we say goodnight here.
I'd just like to say I'm glad that we can talk about this and not bring in the physical pieces. I think so oftentimes we get beat up as a niche in the hobby because we don't have those glamorous pieces. But if anybody's looked at a Rick Barber map, Those are pieces of art.
Oh, God, yes.
So I think we get unfairly slighted, and I say that as an old grognard, and people are going to say, "Oh, you're just whining," but I think that when it comes right down to it, the definitions are there and they're helpful. And you know, maybe the definitions are a little bit too expansive for some people. Everything's a war game. Well, if it's a good game, does it matter? And
yeah.
Really, at the end of the day, that's what my concern.
Yeah, And go play good games. As long as you're having fun, that's cool. I think we're all in agreement that there are appropriate times to use the definitions. And when those times exist, provide us your definition. And when we're outside of those times, who cares, right? I think exactly. we can all come back to, sort of, so what? So, guys, this has been a ton of fun. I know these podcasts are running a little longer. There's a retweeting machine out there. Fred on Twitter retweets a ton of our stuff, and he seems to love our Friday podcast because it gets him out in the woods walking the dog, and that's great. And he was a little irked last week that we only had like a 1-hour podcast. So we're giving him some longer dog walks with a couple of them this season. And so, Fred, I hope you're enjoying a nice long walk with the dog there.
Nice.
This is the second to last podcast of season 5. We are going to wrap up season 5 next week with a visit from Jim. He's coming back. Cyrano is coming back to talk to us about that 2.5-year-long Kriegspiel that they ran. We're going to have a couple of the players involved also and talk some about how they actually pulled this off, the experience of some of the players going through it, some of the things they learned, some of the things that, you know, that caught them by surprise a little bit. Again, Jim's an old hand at doing this. This is the third or fourth of these long-running online Kriegspiels like this that he's done, and there's always some neat insights that come out of every one of them. So that's what we're going to wrap up season 5 with. So this is our second-to-last episode. We'll do our last one next week. and then we're going to take a break for the holidays, and we'll come back in the spring with some more cooler podcasts. And I'm sure both of these dudes are going to come back and visit with us next season at some point. So, Mo, thank you for taking time. Appreciate you being here.
Appreciate you having me on. Thanks a lot.
I hope we didn't have to delay an episode of Whiskey Charlie for this.
No. I was actually watching this, and I was watching the weather because we had the tornado warning to our north, and then we had a tornado warning going through Dallas as I was watching this. But we're all good. The storms have gone by now.
All righty. And we never lost connectivity, so that's
nope.
Great. So, Ian, thank you for making the time to join us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
I think we're safely past the kids' bedtimes, that we're not really impacting your game time with them, right?
No. They got to get up early in the morning and go to their workout. So
good. I'm glad we didn't impact too much on the family time front there. So cool. And then audience, thank you as always for spending the time with us. The shameless begging will now commence. Please take a visit to your favorite podcast site, whether it's iTunes or Podbean or whatever, and throw some ratings at us. Even if you think we suck and you're listening to us for 2 hours, like, you're just a glutton for punishment, but throw some ratings at us because we've got to hit a certain ratings threshold of a minimum number of any kind of ratings to start to show up in the recommendation. And so we'd really appreciate it if you'd help us get some visibility there. Tell all your friends. We're kind of cool guys to hang out with for a little bit. When you're in need of a podcast, when you're stuck on that commute and want some friends to keep you company, here we are. And we'll say thanks to everybody, and we'll catch you on our next episode.